Roads by Robert Louis Stevenson. No amateur will deny that he can find more pleasure in a single drawing over which he can sit a whole quiet forenoon and so gradually study himself into humor with the artist than he can ever extract from the dazzle and accumulation of incongruous impressions that send him weary and stupefied out of some famous picture gallery. But what is thus admitted with regard to art is not extended to the so-called natural beauties. No amount of excess in sublime mountain outline or in the graces of cultivated lowland can do anything, it is supposed, to weaken or degrade the palate. We are not at all sure, however, that moderation and a regimen tolerably austere, even in scenery, are not healthful and strengthening to the taste, and that the best school for a lover of nature is not to be found in one of those countries where there is no stage effect, nothing salient or sudden, but a quiet spirit of orderly and harmonious beauty pervades all the details, so that we can patiently attend to each of the little touches that strike in us, all of them together, the subdued note of the landscape. It is in scenery such as this that we find ourselves in the right temper to seek out small, sequestered loveliness. The constant recurrence of similar combinations of color and outline gradually forces upon us a sense of how the harmony has been built up, and we become familiar with something of nature's mannerism. This is the true pleasure of your rural voluptuary, not to remain awe-stricken before a Mount Chimborazo, not to sit deafened over the big drum and the orchestra, but day by day, to teach himself some new beauty, to experience some new vague and tranquil sensation that has before evaded him. It is not the people who have pined and hungered after nature many a year in the great city pent, as Coleridge said in the poem that made Charles Lamb so much ashamed of himself. It is not those who make the greatest progress in this intimacy with her, or who are most quick to see and have the greatest gusto to enjoy. In this, as in everything else, it is minute knowledge and long-continued loving industry that make the true dilettante. A man must have thought much over scenery before he begins fully to enjoy it. It is no youngling enthusiasm on hilltops that can possess itself of the last essence of beauty. Probably most people's heads are growing bare before they can see all in a landscape that they have the capability of seeing, and even then, it will be only for one little moment of consummation before the faculties are again on the decline, and they that look out of the windows begin to be darkened and restrained in sight. Thus the study of nature should be carried forward thoroughly and with system. Every gratification should be rolled long under the tongue, and we should be always eager to analyze and compare, in order that we may be able to give some more plausible reason for our admirations. True, it is difficult to put even approximately into words the kind of feelings thus called into play. There is a dangerous vice inherent in any such intellectual refining upon vague sensation. The analysis of such satisfactions lends itself very readily to literary affectations, and we can all think of instances where it has shown itself apt to exercise a morbid influence even upon an author's choice of language and the turn of his sentences. And yet there is much that makes the attempt attractive. For any expression, however imperfect, once given to a cherished feeling, seems a sort of legitimation of the pleasure we take in it. A common sentiment is one of those great goods that make life palatable and ever new. The knowledge that another has felt as we have felt and seen things, even if they are little things, not much otherwise than we have seen them, will continue to the end to be one of life's choicest pleasures. Let the reader, then, betake himself in the spirit we have recommended to some of the quieter kinds of English landscape. In those homely and placid agricultural districts, familiarity will bring into relief many things worthy of notice, and urge them pleasantly home to him by a sort of loving repetition, such as the wonderful life-giving speed of windmill sails above the stationary country, the occurrence and recurrence of the same church tower at the end of one long vista after another, and conspicuous among these sources of quiet pleasure, the character and variety of the road itself along which he takes his way. Not only near at hand in the lithe contortions with which it adapts itself to the interchanges of level and slope, but far away also, when he sees a few hundred feet of it upheaved against a hill and shining in the afternoon sun, he will find it an object so changeful and livening that he can always pleasurably busy his mind about it. He may leave the riverside, or fall out of the way of villages, but the road he has always with him, and in the true humor of observation, we'll find in that sufficient company. From its subtle windings and changes of level, there arises a keen and continuous interest that keeps the attention ever alert and cheerful. Every sensitive adjustment to the contour of the ground, every little dip and swerve seems instinct with life and an exquisite sense of balance and beauty. The road rolls upon the easy slopes of the country like a long ship in the hollows of the sea. The very margins of waste ground, as they trench a little farther on the beaten way, or recede again to the shelter of the hedge, have something of the same free delicacy of line, of the same swing and wilfulness. You might think for a whole summer's day, and not have thought it any nearer an end by evening, what concourse and succession of circumstances has produced the least of these deflections, and it is, perhaps, just in this that we should look for the secret of their interest. A footpath across a meadow, in all its human waywardness and unaccountability, in all the grata protovitis of its varying direction, will always be more to us than a railroad well-engineered through a difficult country. No reasoned sequence is thrust upon our attention. We seem to have slipped for one lawless little moment out of the iron rule of cause and effect, and so we revert at once to some of the pleasant old heresies of personification, always poetically orthodox, and attribute a sort of free will, an active and spontaneous life, to the white riband of road that lengthens out and bends and cunningly adapts itself to the inequalities of the land before our eyes. We remember, as we write, some miles of fine, wide highway laid out with conscious aesthetic artifice through a broken and richly cultivated tract of country. It is said that the engineer had Hogarth's line of beauty in his mind as he laid them down. And the result is striking. One splendid, satisfying sweep passes with easy transition into another, and there is nothing to trouble or dislocate the strong continuousness of the main line of the road. And yet there is something wanting. There is here no saving imperfection, none of those secondary curves and little trepidations of direction that carry in natural roads our curiosity actively along with them. One feels at once that this road has not been laboriously grown like a natural road, but made to pattern, and that, while a model may be academically correct in outline, it will always be inanimate and cold. The traveler is also aware of a sympathy of mood between himself and the road he travels. We have all seen ways that have wandered into heavy sand near the seacoast, and trail wearily over the dunes like a trodden serpent. Here we too must plod forward at a dull, laborious pace, and so a sympathy is preserved between our frame of mind and the expression of the relaxed, heavy curves of the roadway. Such a phenomenon, indeed, our reason might perhaps resolve with a little trouble. We might reflect that the present road has been developed out of a tract spontaneously followed by generations of primitive wayfarers, and might see in its expression a testimony that those generations had been affected at the same ground, one after another, in the same manner as we are affected today. Or we might carry the reflection further and remind ourselves that where the air is invigorating and the ground firm under the traveler's foot, his eye is quick to take advantage of small undulations, and he will turn carelessly aside from the direct way wherever there is anything beautiful to examine or some promise of a wider view, so that even a bush of wild roses may permanently bias and deform the straight path over the meadow. Whereas, where the soil is heavy, one is preoccupied with the labor of mere progression and goes with a bowed head heavily and unobservantly forward. Reason, however, will not carry us the whole way, for the sentiment often recurs in situations where it is very hard to imagine any possible explanation. And indeed, if we drive briskly along a good, well-made road in an open vehicle, we shall experience this sympathy almost at its fullest. We feel the sharp settle of the springs at some curiously twisted corner. After a steep ascent, the fresh air dances in our faces as we rattle precipitately down the other side, and we find it difficult to avoid attributing something headlong, a sort of abandon, to the road itself. The mere winding of the path is enough to enliven a long day's walk in even a commonplace or dreary countryside. Something that we have seen from miles back upon an eminence is so long hid from us as we wander through folded valleys or among woods that our expectation of seeing again is sharpened into a violent appetite, and as we draw nearer, we impatiently quicken our steps and turn every corner with a beating heart. It is through these prolongations of expectancy, this succession of one hope to another, that we live out long sessions of pleasure in a few hours' walk. It is in following these capricious sinuosities that we learn only bit by bit, and through one coquettish reticence after another, much as we learn the heart of a friend, the whole loveliness of the country. This disposition always preserves something new to be seen, and takes us, like a careful cicerone, to many different points of distant view before it allows us finally to approach the hoped-for destination. In its connection with the traffic, and whole friendly intercourse with the country, there is something very pleasant in that succession of saunterers and brisk and business-like passers-by that peoples our ways and helps to build up what Walt Whitman calls the cheerful voice of the public road, the gay, fresh sentiment of the road. But out of the great network of ways that binds all life together from the hill farm to the city, there is something individual to most, and, on the whole, nearly as much choice on the score of company as on the score of beauty or easy travel. On some we are never long without the sound of wheels, and folk pass us by so thickly that we lose the sense of their number. But on others, about little frequented districts, a meeting is an affair of moment. We have the sight far off of someone coming toward us, the growing definiteness of the person, and then the brief passage and salutation, and the road left empty in front of us for perhaps a great while to come. Such encounters have a wistful interest that can hardly be understood by the dweller in places more populous. We remember standing beside a countryman once, in the mouth of a quiet by-street in a city that was more than ordinarily crowded and bustling. He seemed stunned and bewildered by the continual passage of different faces, and after a long pause, during which he appeared to search for some suitable expression, he said timidly that there seemed to be a great deal of meeting thereabouts. The phrase is significant. It is the expression of town life in the language of the long, solitary country highways. A meeting of one with one was what this man had been used to in the pastoral uplands from which he came. And the concourse of the streets was, in his eyes only, an extraordinary multiplication of such meetings. And now we come to that last and most subtle quality of all, to that sense of prospect, of outlook, that is brought so powerfully to our minds by a road. In real nature, as well as in old landscapes, beneath that impartial daylight in which a whole variegated plan is plunged and saturated, the line of the roads leads the eye forth with the vague sense of desire up to the green limit of the horizon. Travel is brought home to us, and we visit in spirit every grove and hamlet that tempts us in the distance. Sehnsucht, the passion for what is beyond, Sehnsucht, the passion for what is ever beyond, is livingly expressed in that white riband of possible travel that severs the uneven country. Not a ploughman following his plough up the shining furrow, not the blue smoke of any cottage in a hollow, but is brought to us with a sense of nearness and attainability by this wavering line of junction. There is a passionate paragraph in Werther that strikes the very key. "When I came hither," he writes, "how the beautiful valley invited me on every side as I gazed down into it from the hilltop. There the wood, that I might mingle in its shadows, there the mountain summits, that I might look down from them over the broad country, the interlinked hills, the secret valleys, oh, to lose myself among their mysteries. I hurried into the midst, and came back without finding aught I hoped for, alas. The distance is like the future. A vast hole lies in the twilight before our spirit. Sight and feelings alike plunge and lose themselves in the prospect, and we yearn to surrender our whole being and let it be filled full with all the rapture of one single glorious sensation, and, alas, when we hasten to the fruition, when there is changed to here, all is afterwards as it was before, and we stand in our indigent and cramped estate, and our soul thirsts after a still ebbing elixir." It is to this wandering and uneasy spirit of anticipation that roads minister. Every little vista, every little glimpse that we have of what lies before us, gives the impatient imagination rein, so that it can outstrip the body and already plunge into the shadow of the woods and overlook from the hilltop the plain before it, and wander in the windings of the valleys that are still far in front. The road is already there. We shall not be long behind. It is as if we were marching with the rear of a great army and, from far before, heard the acclamation of the people as the vanguard entered some friendly and jubilant city. Would not every man, through all the long miles of march, feel as if he also were within the gates? The End. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.